This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
This audio interview is sponsored by Response Biomedical, delivering rapid, reliable biological field tests with RAMP, the first and only field-approved anthrax test. For more information, visit www.responsebio.com.
Domestic Preparedness is with Dr. George C. Benjamin, the executive director of the American Public Health Association. Dr. Benjamin is well known in the world of public health as a leader, practitioner, and administrator. He came to APHA in 2002 from his position as secretary of the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, where he played a key role developing Maryland's bioterrorism plan. He is board certified in internal medicine and is a fellow of the American College of Physicians. Dr. Benjamin's distinguished career includes service as the chief of emergency medicine at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, chair of the Department of Community Health and Ambulatory Care at the District of Columbia General Hospital, acting commissioner for public health for D.C., and also interim director of the Emergency Ambulatory Bureau of D.C.'s Fire Department. He is a member of several committees, notably the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Director's Advisory Committee. Dr. Benjamin, it's truly an honor to be here with you today. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us.
John, thank you very much for having me. I'm going to enjoy doing this.
Well, let's start with segment one. We'd like to know your overview of the state of the nation's public health as it relates to all hazards preparedness. How do you see it, Dr. Benjamin, and what needs to be done in your view?
Well, let me start by saying that preparedness is a process and not a point in time. And that's important because everybody wants to say, you know, when are we going to know when we're prepared? And it's important for all of us to understand that over time you get there, but it doesn't stay there. And so whatever you know, when you improve your performance, you have to do lots of things to continue that level of preparedness. So it's, if you think about it, in what we do every day, it's your capacity to know what's going to happen and respond quickly in an organized manner and a proficient manner. It's also the capacity of a system to deal effectively and efficiently when things go wrong and when things that you don't anticipate happen. And so that's kind of what preparedness is. It's a real challenge, but most people know it when they see it. But you're never always going to be completely prepared because it really means prepared for what?
Well, now at the federal level, there continue to be changes. Last month, we were with Captain Mike Anderson, who's the National Program Manager for the MMRS. And this month, that system is going to FEMA. Now, tell me, what does this mean for the state and local public health communities? Is that a good thing, would you say?
Well, MMRS was always designed to be a holistic, all-hazard preparedness type of approach. So the fact that it's going to be at FEMA within the Department of Homeland Security, I think in many ways puts it with the other parts of the system that's creating all-hazard preparedness. The most important issue for something like MMRS is not necessarily where it sits, but how it integrates with all the other pieces. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, if we move the box from one organization to another and people still don't talk together, they don't drill together, they don't plan together, we're not going to be any better prepared than we were, 10, 15 years ago. So at the end of the day, it's not about really where this particular organization sits because mm-hmm. of its more broad mission, but how they work and play well together.
Well, you also have the HRSA preparedness program moving to HHS headquarters downtown. Now, do you see this important program getting the command attention it deserves with that move?
One of the challenges in this program is it really has never really been able to get the kind of national attention that it deserves in light of the fact of its goal, which is to improve the preparedness mm-hmm. And surge capacity for hospital systems. And we hope that now being in the, in fact, under the direct supervision of the Assistant Secretary for Public Health Preparedness, that this program will get that kind of senior level attention. At the end of the day, though, it's, again, going to be important that this program not just act as a stimulus for, you know, the overall types of hospital preparedness, but that it does a kind of coordination across all systems and across all of the various federal agencies, and then with the private sector, with groups like the Hospital Association, the physician groups, my organization, American Public Health Association, in order to make this actually work.
Now, are there any other organizational changes that give you encouragement or indeed concern that you want to discuss?
Well, clearly, the movement back officially to Health and Human Services for the stockpile. You know, it was one of those political giveaways when it was moved to Homeland Security. It never really physically left, but it made the communication and deployment more complicated, being in Homeland Security. Now that it's back, I think it streamlines the communications aspect. It still has some challenges in terms of deployment and the linkage with local communities, but it's going to be a much better place for it to be, I think, at the federal level.
Yeah. Let's now turn in this segment specifically to bioterrorism preparedness. Your association notes that all 50 states now have developed bioterrorism response plans, but that no state or city is fully prepared to respond to a bioterrorist attack and the resulting health consequences. Now, in your view, what needs to be done? And by that I mean, aside from more funding, you know, what should be done here?
I think better integration into our other infection control programs. When we had the anthrax attacks in the Washington metropolitan region, we pulled epidemiologists and disease control people from all of our programs, including our AIDS programs, our STD programs, even our chronic disease programs. And so more fully integrating the biopreparedness programs into our other surveillance and disease programs, I think, is one very important step. The other thing is doing more mini drills and drilling around or evaluating ourselves around the things that that happen every day. So when you have a large foodborne outbreak, that is a manifestation of a large infectious process that could easily mimic what could be done intentionally, and that will help us determine our preparedness. So to the extent that we can take things that happen every day, use those as models of our level of preparedness, and then improve upon them, I think are going to be a very, very important next step.
Well, now you mentioned surveillance. Tell me your thoughts on disease detection. The association is upbeat about this area. So if you would, tell me a little bit about your views on the CDC's field officer program for the CEFOs. How's that going, and are the states getting the assistance that they need here?
Well, there's been a national effort for us to improve the epidemiologic capacity of our nation. That means to improve the capacity and the numbers of the people that actually do the disease detection and figure out whether or not two cases over here, one case over there, and a third case sitting in another part of the state or another state is actually linked. And that means that they have been working very hard to enumerate the number of epidemiologists we need, and to get them into the right places. So this program, the Career Epidemiologic Field Officer, was designed to make sure that in every state and some of our large cities, there is a well-trained person in epidemiology to serve both as a role model, to help build capacity, and to serve as a linkage between the states and the federal government. And that program seems to be expanding and going well. We do need to continue to expand the EIS program. There are lots of efforts in right now to try to encourage us to develop these programs and develop more people in them to give them better training. Because at the end of the day, a good epidemiologist, somebody who really knows this work, is going to be the way that we're going to truly connect the dots for these disease outbreaks.
Now, with regard to the stockpile, an abiding concern continues to be the management and distribution of SNS. What are you recommending there in terms of staffing and the distribution strategies? I mean, how far have we got to go to resolve that challenge?
Well, we have a long way to go to adopt that challenge. Even states that have actually had to use a stockpile mm-hmm. are continuing to have to remodel the way they do it.
Mm-hmm.
I was just talking with a local health official in one of our big cities just the other day, mm-hmm. and we were talking about the real challenge that he had. He originally had a plan where everybody would go to one large central distribution point mm-hmm. To get their medications. And he recognized very quickly that just for his city, that wasn't going to work. And so that's the big challenge. The other challenge we have is simply making sure that everybody is aware of what's in the stockpile, know what they're going to get. The first time we used a stockpile in Maryland, we got these huge dope bottles, and we had to break them down. And we had real challenges around what the proper legal authority was for a nurse to dispense.
Mm-hmm.
Making sure that people counted the medications correctly, labeled the bottles correctly. It's a very, very detailed issue, even on the pharmaceutical side. And now that there's a lot of discussion around enlarging the stockpile to include a variety of other things, ventilators, mm-hmm. respirators,
mm-hmm.
those create huge maintenance and logistical problems for the stockpile. And so it's going to be a real challenge. And I think we're going to have to create a blended type of process, one where we have certainly the big stockpile that we will fly in and bring in and work all the logistics through to getting those to the right places, and the pharmaceuticals or equipment mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. the right patients at the right time. But also we're going to have to create a more robust distribution system mm-hmm. within the communities themselves
sure.
so they can utilize things until those stockpiles get there to replenish their supplies.
Dr. Benjamin, with regard to the distribution, can we talk a little bit about citizen engagement and thoughts you have on how you secure that for the local distribution issues that you addressed?
Well, there are several models being tried. One, of course, is to try to engage Citizen Corps individuals and train them to be part of the distribution system in a variety of places, from being receptionist to actually being part of the medical part of this distribution. It is a big task. Again, in my experience with pharmacists, it was a very narrow piece of this. Right after 9/11 and then after the anthrax attacks, we had lots of people that wanted to volunteer. We really didn't quite have the infrastructure to manage those volunteers. Mm-hmm. And so both the Medical Reserve Corps and the Citizens Corps create a capacity for us now to mm-hmm. be able to utilize some of those volunteers. The big issue, though, is training, initial training, and then maintaining competency.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that they've done in Maryland was to train pharmacists as an example. And they taught those pharmacists about the stockpile, what was in the stockpile, how to break down the stockpile, and in effect, credential them. They even got a little ID card
mm-hmm.
so that they could actually get through the secure areas when they were deployed to be part of the stockpile. And these were a way of getting people who were duly licensed pharmacists who had volunteered in our community engaged in the preparedness action. That can be done for any number of individuals, disciplines, to try to get them trained. The real challenge, though, of course, is keeping their training current.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that just basically one looks at the medical training for basic life support,
mm-hmm.
CPR, and the huge sure. enterprise that we have just to keep people competent in being able to do basic resuscitation is a huge enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
We have not yet created that kind of enterprise for these corps in terms
mm-hmm.
of we have them, we've got the names, but we haven't built the training mechanism
mm-hmm.
To keep them current, to standardize it to some degree, mm-hmm. So that we actually know what people are competent and trained to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about supply chain issues, guaranteeing supply and having a program that's going to ensure that, reliable supply for distribution?
Supply is going to be a real challenge, and we've got a first of all, recognize there's going to have to be multiple mechanisms to do this. I think that's going to be very important. Secondly, we're going to have to look at various ways for us to ensure that when I sign a contract with someone to get a particular supply, let's say respirators, That they don't have five or six other people that they've signed contracts with, so that in effect, when I ask for a deliverable in our just-in-time society, that I can actually depend on that. And that's not just a problem for respirators, but that's a problem for, you know, any of a food. That's a problem for any of the medical supplies. It's a problem for gloves. And we know that in certain types of emergencies, our need's going to outstrip that supply. And so we're going to have to, both through drills, gaming, preparedness games, figure out what those needs are, and then build, in effect, a realistic supply chain so that we can have some kind of dependability that if we ask for the stuff is going to be there. The other thing I think we're going to need to figure out is to the extent that we build some of that capacity within our existing supply chain. So, for example, we decide that part of a medication distribution plan is that people can go to pharmacies and get it. And we, in effect, agree to build up the pharmacy supply by some small percent in order to be able to have extra medicines on the shelf so that we can go to them in a short period of time. Again, my experience during the anthrax attacks was that we basically raided, and it was just our plan, we raided our STD clinics of all the Cipro they had. What we hadn't done, we never drilled it. We hadn't gotten to that point yet. And so there was resistance on part of the pharmacists to give up the medications, even though it was in the disaster plan. There was, we hadn't figured out how to pick it up and move it to the clinics. And so some of the logistics we hadn't thought through. We worked through it. But those are the kinds of things that have got to happen. And then you've got to figure out how to restock. What the rules are around restocking those supplies. So it is a logistics nightmare that we really haven't resolved yet.
Well, that leads me to another thought. Do you think we'll ever see an approach to medical countermeasures that will involve, I think you're touching on it, pre-positioning or indeed widespread self-administering in the case of certain antidotes and vaccines and so forth?
Well, Secretary Leavitt actually has it right. You know, there was we were at one point moving down a path for a single solution, and I think he's proposed multiple solutions to the distribution of pharmaceuticals, vaccines, et cetera. And I think he's got it right. I think we're going to have to rely on a plethora of things, such as in some cases, there's got to be trusted agents who are going to have medications at home. There's going to be people that we're going to trust with having our stockpile locally and being able to send patients there. There may be some of our pharmacists. It may be some of the large grocery store chains that have pharmacists in it, pharmacies in it. We are going to be may have to look at people that we can trust to deliver things, people that know those communities. And that, you know, right now there's been some discussion around the Postal Service because, again, they know where every home is. They may or may not be the solution. I know there's been some working with the state and local health departments with the Postal Service to try to look at that as a, a piece of the solution. And then, of course, at the end of the day, you're going to have to look at your first responders, whether they be police, fire, EMS, as another distribution point. So there's going to be a range of solutions to make that happen. And that means we're going to have to look very carefully at issues around storage, security, legal authority to do it. Because at the end of the day, there was a time in which we thought we could just kind of wave all this stuff and people would be okay with it. But increasingly we're seeing that the expectation is that we would provide a disaster response within the framework of everyday life. That's probably not a realistic framework, but there are expectations that people have, and we haven't quite defined what those expectations will be when something bad happens.
Let's look at another area, shortfalls in lab capacity. The APHA has said that 51 of 83 state and local labs in the laboratory response network have had delays receiving the CDC-supplied reagents for the detection of the bioterrorism agents. What are you recommending here that should be done?
We really need that's a funding and it's a resource issue in many ways. It's about making sure that the funding's there and the other resources in terms of delivery are there. to ensure that those reagents are made. You know, these are specialized reagents. There are challenges sometimes to making those reagents and getting them distributed. And it's about really just paying attention to make sure that we have them. The other challenge you have, of course, is that some of these reagents, particularly when something new happens, are not widely available because it is new. And we have to develop the fast science and fast chemistry to be able to identify when a new reagent is required, create it, and then deliver it very quickly into the hands of the people that, we need to do the identification. And also, I think from a policy perspective, we've built the Laboratory Response Network as really a national arm at the local level of the federal laboratory system. And we really need to treat it as a much more fluid system. So that the things are initially, certainly things need to go to the senior most reference lab. But over time, we need to very quickly move that out to these laboratory response areas. The other thing is training. Making sure that these technicians at the state level have the adequate training so they can you know, diagnose through the laboratory means correctly or identify a positive test versus a negative test. And that does require a fair amount of both initial competency training and then ongoing proficiency training.
In this segment, let's turn now to your thoughts on hospital preparedness. I know you have concerns about shortfalls in stockpiling, which you mentioned earlier. Now, how do you see incentivizing stockpiling, especially in the private hospitals? Do you see JCO putting down the hammer by instituting tough standards or what?
Well, I think certainly we need to do some incentivizing, and certainly by providing some guidance, that would be helpful. But, you know, at the end of the day, the reason hospitals, they follow the money. And this is going to be, have to be done in a way in which funding is going to have to be found to allow for that stockpiling to occur. When I talked earlier about the importance of building stockpiles, for example, in community pharmacies, we had the same issue in hospital pharmacies. If you really want to build a stockpile, you don't have to build a huge increase in the stockpile. But you do need to increase it incrementally in a variety of places. And one place to do that may be the hospitals. And so it may be worth our dollars to invest in hospitals in such a way that they're able to increase their, stockpiles. What do we get out of this as, a total preparedness of effort? We get an institution that is commonly rotating their medications, making sure that the medications are up to date. And it reduces our need to move and fly in these huge stockpiles, at least for a relatively small contained event. So there is some benefit in doing that. It could be done through the hospital finance system, which, of course, all the economists will cringe when I say that. But that is a mechanism. It can be done through a grants program. It can be done through a reimbursement from a fund that we put aside to then reimburse hospitals over time to do that. But at the end of the day, it's both an incentive as well as a funding issue, and we have to deal with both.
Yeah. Now, this is these are public funds you're suggesting that would go to both public and private hospitals, correct?
That's correct. I mean, the truth of the matter is that half of healthcare financing comes from the federal government, so. And at the end of the day, it all comes out of our pockets, the individual citizen's pocket, whether it's tax dollars or dollars that we chose to discretionarily spend. But it's all about preparedness.
Yeah. Now, should the level of care be adjusted in the mass casualty response? You had mentioned earlier about expectations that some of these events are not the norm, so therefore there's a different metric, if you will. One of our writers is Pennsylvania's Mike Allsweet, and he's suggesting an approach that he calls pessimistic disaster planning for surge situations, where he says you go from delaying care to degrading it to finally denying it. It's pretty tough, but unfortunately realistic. Is that where health systems may have to go?
I would think that we should not do that.
Okay.
And let me give an alternative view to that. First of all, you give the best care that you can within the situation that you can. And doesn't mean that somebody in some little room should not plan for the worst. I'm not saying that. Someone has to do that kind of planning. But at the end of the day, we're not going to behave that way. We usually don't make those kinds of decisions unless we're in a really dire strait. Now, that does happen. We saw that in Katrina, where people had to make some very, very difficult decisions. And what I would prefer to do is prepare people to make innovative decisions and, again, do the best that they can with what they have. And so that means to equip them with the tools and capacity to think out of the box so that while the care that they deliver hopefully will be as equivalent, they're using different mechanisms to get there. Now, does that mean at the end of the day you won't have to declare some patients expectant? You know, that's true. But then there's a standard of care for dealing with expectant patients. You don't just put them in a corner and leave them. And we're a long way. I mean, we I can think of very few scenarios where that's the case. Obviously, a nuclear explosion, a pandemic flu with the most virulent organism you can think of, that might happen. But in most cases, we're still going to try to maintain a high level of care. And I would prefer that we plan to provide for that care versus simply allowing us to plan for the lowest common denominator.
The APHA also recognizes the need for plans to address the shortage of healthcare workers and absenteeism. Do you see efforts like the ESRVIP and the Citizen Corps as workable solutions?
Well, there are two pieces of the shortage. Let me talk about the shortage in steady state where we are today. And that's a shortage basically because you have an event and you just don't have enough people to help you take care of that. Actually, the usual thing that happens is you have lots of people. You just don't quite know who's qualified to do what. And so ESRVIP and the Citizen Corps and the Medical Reserve Corps are, again, our efforts to know who we have, to know that they're trained to do what they say they can do, and to verify that through some kind of electronic means. It's a new effort, and it will provide some help in trying to validate that. The other problem we have is a long-term problem that we have in terms of all of the health professions. There's a baby boomers age out. We are going to suffer a reduction in doctors, nurses, public health practitioners. On the public health side, we estimate anywhere from a quarter to half of all public health workers will be eligible for retirement soon. Now, obviously, a disaster doesn't mean they can't come back and help, but that does mean that you don't have that ready workforce that you can just grab today. And we are not doing everything we need to do to build that pipeline. And that really needs to be done fairly urgently. And that means getting as many young men and women into sixth and seventh grade through the sciences so that they can then choose to have careers, hopefully, in preparedness, health, nursing, medicine, whatever, public health on the other end. And we're going to be competing right now with engineers and teachers and the other professions, the technology community. And we need to build that pipeline today if we're really serious about having that workforce in the future.
Sure. Now, of course, there's also the Medical Reserve Corps, which we mentioned earlier. HHS is putting stock in that effort. You are as well.
I am. And it's the medical equivalent of the Citizen Corps. It's a component of it. And it much more needs to be done in terms of making sure that system is highly functional, integrating it to some degree with our DMATs, Disaster Medical Teams, and some of our other response teams, so that when they show up on a scene, they can work in an effective manner with those people in the Medical Reserve Corps that are local. The one challenge we do have with all of these various corps that we're putting up is that they're actually not extra bodies. If you have somebody who's in the Medical Reserve Corps, they are leaving somebody's medical community to provide assistance. And so as long as they're not needed back home, that's great. But it doesn't give you any new bodies if you're expecting them and they're double hatting in that responsibility. Again, we saw that a lot in the police response after 9/11. We had people both, you know, who were, because these people, by the way, tend to be folks that volunteer a lot. Yeah. So you have police officers and firefighters who also are in the National Guard.
Yeah.
And when they get called up for National Guard duty, then you leave them you lose them from their police duties. And we have the same problem in healthcare. We have the person who's works in the emergency department at your local hospital. They're also on the DMAT team. They're part of the Medical Reserve Corps. And so we need to make sure we don't double count these folks.
Turning now to pandemic preparedness, a major focus for your association. In your view, how is the cooperation today between DHS and HHS in this regard?
I've been impressed that both Secretary Chertoff and Leavitt have been working so closely together. And I'm glad to see that, just because, as you know, this is a very, very complicated area of management. And a pandemic is not the same as a bomb going off. And so there's going to need to be strong cooperation between the two agencies. We believe pretty strongly that this is going to need to be a health response, and that for all practical purposes, HHS should be leading the charge on that. But there's a very, very strong role for Homeland Security in support of that effort.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you see as the role for the Department of Defense? Is it just evacuation, or is it going to be substantial medical support? And finally, if so, do you see DOD finding the funds to play that civil support role, given its core warfighting mission?
Well, you know, saving the American people is not a fiscal issue. So that if something bad happens, we're going to do it and figure out how to pay for it later. So I don't see that money, at least in terms of the response, ought to play any role whatsoever. But I do think that we need to be clear about the DOD role. And what does DOD do very well? DOD is an extraordinary logistical operation. They do that very, very well. They're, you know, smart people. That's one of the things I learned when I was in the Army. There are very, very smart people in the military who know how to do some things organizationally very, very well. And the Army Medical Corps, Military Medical Corps, Navy, Air Force. I'm biased towards the Army since I was in the Army. But the Military Medical Corps are also very extraordinary in their efforts, provide great medical care, et cetera. Having said that, they're quite busy right now. And I think it's, again, when I talk about us double hatting and counting people twice, I think that we're going to be really challenged. And we think that the Military Medical Corps is going to be able to assist in any meaningful manner in terms of diverting because of the war and taking care of the troops and providing this kind of assistance. I mean, there certainly may be some local stuff they can do. So if it happens in a local community where there's a military post, as part of that response capacity, sure, there'll be a great help. But in terms of broadly expecting their assistance, I think it's going to be really challenging for them to be able to do that. To the extent that you build that into your response plan, I think it makes some sense. They're part of the community, and they're going to need to be part of the response from that community response. So let's say, for example, a pandemic flu occurs in a state in which there is a military post. They're going to be part of the response for that local community. They're going to be part of whatever discussions there are for isolation and quarantine. They're going to have issues around with their troops that live on post and their troops that live off post and their families. And so we need to fully integrate them into our plans another part of our community. And we need to figure out what assets they're able to share. And quite frankly, what assets the civilian community are able to share with our military members in order to be able to effectively respond to whatever happens. So I think we shouldn't look at them we sort of look at them as a resource, but we need to be realistic about what they can bring to the table, at least today. And then in the future, when they're not as tasked overseas, we can certainly begin to rethink about how they can be more fully integrated into what's going on every day.
Well, how do you see the public health leadership improving the national response plan for the pandemic response?
You know, it's interesting. Doctors and cops think differently. We approach activities quite differently. Mm-hmm. We bring both great skills and knowledge through our lens to an activity. And we both have aspects of what we do which are counterintuitive mm-hmm. to others, that if you're not in the business. And so to the extent that you can get those two groups working well together from the preparedness side of the activity, through the which includes drills so that people know each other very well, and then can help read each other's thoughts as they're doing the response, and then have the respect for one another so that when we recommend that they do something that's counterintuitive, that they say, okay, and then maybe follow that along because there's a trust built up there. The same way we would do with them if they did something we thought was counterintuitive, but they're the experts. I think that will improve overall preparedness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be important because at the end of the day, one of the challenges we always have with public health activities is public confidence. There's a lot of great stories where public health practitioners have maintained public trust by being open, transparent, and telling people what they know, and doing effective risk communication. And when we've not done that, we've lost the trust of the public as public health practitioners. Mm-hmm. And that's always resulted in a pretty bad outcome. I mean, there have been riots because of mm-hmm. poor communication and the lack of transparency. And so that really needs to be weighed into a lot of these public health decisions. So mm-hmm. what I mean by that is, if you don't need to stop people from traveling because you know it's not going to do any good, then don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless there's some other security reason for doing it, don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you know that it's not going to do you any good to isolate people,
mm-hmm.
I've always argued that unless we're prepared to really do very strenuous things, then in most cases it makes no sense to even threaten locking people up, putting guards around folks, because you're not going to, you know, it doesn't have a medical purpose, at least from a medical perspective, it doesn't make any sense. And sometimes you have to work with your police colleagues so they really understand that aspect of maintaining mm-hmm. Disease control. You know, the first response we often hear from people is to kind of isolate everything, because that's mm-hmm. kind of a normal police response. And that's not necessarily the best medical response. It may be, but it's not always. And mm-hmm. and we need to we bring that expertise to the table about disease transmission that I think really needs to be paid attention to.
Now, do you see the federal agencies reworking the National Response Plan to bring into play all the levels of government? Is that coming?
Well, you know, they're redoing it now. They are doing the National Response Plan now. Hopefully they'll get that finished pretty quickly and out, and so people can take another look at it. At the end of the day, you know, all of these plans fall apart when something happens. But they're a roadmap mm-hmm. is what they are. They're a roadmap and they're first event guidance. They're the first few steps you're going to do when something goes wrong. And we need to get that right. And we need to get the integration right. We need to get the decisions about getting the right people in the room early so that you're not playing catch up on all these events. That's mm-hmm. that's not our biggest challenge, is playing catch up
mm-hmm.
when something happens. And I tell you, there are probably two big areas that have never gotten right in disasters. One is communications. Communications has been the vein of our existence and always has been pretty much throughout mankind for disasters. And we need to finally figure out how to get that right. It's getting the right information to the right people at the right time and to maintain public trust. Second issue, of course, is logistics. Getting the right stuff to the right people at the right time. So to maintain some degree of dependability in the system. Mm-hmm. And we haven't quite gotten either one of those right. And that's not a criticism. That's just it's a comment. Mm-hmm. It's a recognition of two areas that always go wrong, mm-hmm. that I think everybody in the disaster preparedness community will agree with, where we need some work. Mm-hmm. We have some work to do.
Well, how far do we have to go at the state and local levels in developing continuity operations plans for health departments specifically?
Well, we've got a lot to do. I don't know specifically every state or local health department in the country where they were. We started talking about this and when I was in Maryland back in 96, 97. People thought we were nuts. And then the good news is we had a place to go after 9/11 because we actually had thought about it. And thought a little bit about continuity of operations. And what we discovered was, well, we still had a ways to go. But we were okay. We figured out a place to go where we'd have computers and how we could talk to one another and a communications tree. And we talked about all those very basic things, but we also discovered we had a lot of things we needed to do. APHA, my staff and I right now, are working on our continuity of operations plan. You know, we've had emergency plans for building evacuations and we do fire drills and we have an emergency number and all those kinds of things. But we discovered that we still have things we still here need to do, even though we think about this a lot. Mm-hmm. The Legacy Foundation, which is the company that was set up after the tobacco settlement, has a interesting continuity of operations plan. They've actually developed one whereby they allow their employees to, you know, work from home, and they've set up ways in which their employees can be supported at home. Now, why would the Legacy Foundation be interested in that? Well, it turns out that they're very much involved in tobacco cessation activity. Mm-hmm. And we know that stress goes through the roof in disasters. And if we're serious about, you know, curtailing what we view as public enemy number one, which is tobacco, that we need to make sure that we have a functioning entity that can actually do tobacco cessation. Mm-hmm. Now, I bring them up because they're an example, but we have the same problem for our substance abuse programs. What are you going to do with all these people that are on methadone and other mm-hmm. drugs for therapeutic purposes? What are you going to do mm-hmm. with all these people with mental illness mm-hmm. when their treatment programs get disrupted? Mm-hmm. What are we going to do with people with chronic disease programs? Who need their medication mm-hmm. and get their medication just in time.
Yeah, dialysis.
Dialysis patients, et cetera. We saw that in Katrina. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about continuity of operations, we know that there is a lot of effort with big national and global companies. But the smaller companies are really just beginning to do this work. And we need to spend a lot of time with them and helping them to really get there. Now, there's just their checklists and their brochures and there's lots of advice. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, if you're running a small business in a community, that may very well be essential for that community's well-being. You often don't have time to do this. It's mm-hmm. not on your radar screen. Mm-hmm. So we need to both incentivize them in some way to get involved in preparedness activity, and then to help them know when they're better prepared today when they were for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Again, under the rubric that you're never quite going to be completely prepared.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, getting back to social distancing strategies, when you talked about isolation and what have you, how do you see balancing those strategies and therapeutics, be they vaccine supply or antivirals?
That's a very tough question, and it is because, of course, once we have a vaccine, it changes the whole ballgame, right? Our approach to addressing disease transmission changes completely. And the truth of the matter is, as we said earlier, about supply chain issues, we've got to make sure we have enough of the antiviral agents that they are effective, meaning there's not substantial viral resistance to the medications, and then we need to have the capacity to deliver those medications into the hands of the right people. And then, of course, you've got to hopefully they have to take it and there's compliance with taking the medication. And to the extent we are able to do that and have a robust system to do that, we can probably limit or modify our social distancing strategies, you know, so that you we do social distancing until you're quote-unquote protected, whatever that may mean. It's going to be a big event, and all of our planning for pandemic flu recognizes that it's going to come in waves. There's going to be huge reductions in our workforce because people are going to stay home. We're just beginning to think about really how to make that work. We've never had to do the kind of social distancing that we're planning for a large pandemic. We've never had to do anything like that. And so we don't quite know what it means to do that. Of course, by the way, we stay at home when we have big snowstorms. So to the extent that people can stay home for 2 or 3 days, it's probably not a big deal. But, you know, APHA, we just did a survey of the public, and we focused very much on vulnerable populations. We kind of looked at the public broadly, and we discovered that, you know, the vast majority of Americans still aren't prepared even for a three-day activity. And that many people, up to 40% of the people that were prepared, are less prepared today than they were before. They all know they need to do it. They just haven't done it yet.
In this segment, let's drill a little deeper into the quarantine and isolation piece of pandemic preparedness. How far along have the states gone in clarifying who has the legal authority to enforce containment measures?
Well, almost all of them have looked at their public health laws. And then there's been a variety of responses to that, from totally overhauling their public health law to, in effect, looking at it and say, well, the authority that we have right now is reasonable and allow us to do what we think we need to do. At the end of the day, they've not really been tested. Most of these laws still haven't been tested. And we really don't know what will ultimately happen when we actually have to apply them. Almost every state in the nation has a rule that allows the local health officer or the state health official to do whatever steps are necessary to stop the transmission of disease, infectious disease. But whether or not they meet legal muster, whether or not they can implement and then go to the court and, you know, have the court validate their action, whether or not they have to go to whether they can make the call or they have to go to their political authority, which may be the governor or the mayor, to actually have them implement the activity, still remains to be seen. And then I think the other piece of this is, particularly for those people who have modernized their laws recently, making sure that those laws have protections for people who are sequestered. I think it's a very, very important piece of this. In Maryland, we worked very closely with a variety of groups, including the ACLU and other patient groups, privacy groups, to make sure that we had a process that we were comfortable with that both gave the state health official the authority to implement on very narrow grounds isolation, quarantine for broad populations. Legal protections for the individuals for which we would subject those authorities to, and a process by which the courts would get involved for the protection and legal protection of those individuals. And we thought that we struck a good balance there. Other states, are looking at ways to do that. Alaska has recently, looked at their public health laws as another example.
Now, are you satisfied with the CDC quarantine regulations?
Overall, yeah. I mean, there's some issues around the airline component of that, where they're asking for data from the airlines and who's on the passenger manifest, et cetera. I think that's necessary to do. And as I understand the regulations, CDC is only asking for that information. Not as a course of routine, but only when there's an event or they actually have to go out and find somebody, then they want to have rapid access to that information. And so the truth of the matter is we've all flown in airplanes, and You know, people are rarely in the seats that they, well, I shouldn't say it that way. People are often not in the seats where they're initially assigned, and particularly when you're on these airlines that, which you don't have assigned seats. And trying to connect the dots of who might have been exposed on a particular airline for an infectious disease is an important activity that is part of contact tracing that CDC has to do. And unless you can get the information, at least who's on the airline, how do you get a hold of them? And to the extent you can figure out who was around them and who also might have been exposed, if you don't have that information, you can't do proper contact tracing. So, and we would all be complaining if after the fact, if they didn't have that information. So we ought to give them the capacity to have that information up front. I know there are legal challenges. I know there are privacy issues involved, but we can work through those.
Well, that leads me to the next question. What's the state of play for the Department of Transportation and HHS collaboration on the interstate transportation issues and the airport closures and the like?
I know they're talking about them and working on some of those issues. I don't know that we truly figured out exactly who has the final authority to close an airport. I've jokingly heard some of my colleagues say, well, I may not have the authority to close the airport, but I can quarantine it. And that's probably true. And then it depends on whether the airport is an authority or whether it's owned by the state. In my state of Maryland, the airport's actually part of the State Department of Transportation. It's not an airport authority per se. It's part of the state. But, of course, it sits in a county where there's a county health official. And so the county health official is often involved with activities around the airport. And they've had events at the Baltimore-Washington International Airport where the county health official has been involved with people who have been immigrants who have been coming in, refugees who have been brought back from airplanes from various parts of the world, and has been involved in principally screening them for infectious diseases like tuberculosis. And that's an interaction between both the local health official and the CDC quarantine service, who works very collaboratively to screen people for infectious diseases. That is not as tight as we would like to think it is.
In this last segment, I'd like to finish with three questions that would interest our Don Prep members at the operational level. Dr. Benjamin, what can you tell us about what's happening with development of standard diagnostic testing for influenza?
The ultimate goal is to have a rapid test, one which you can take a particular body fluid and actually come up with something that says this person does or doesn't have influenza. The challenge you have, of course, is that there is a period of time in which the person may not be positive. And there's the other challenge, of course, is that having the test in time when you have a brand new novel virus and developing that technology very quickly. It's all about fast science, and we're still working on it. And then the question is, how do you rapidly deploy that material out to the right people that can make these kinds of tests, usually medical personnel, be able to do rapid screening. It's still a challenge for us. It's still a big challenge for us. And again, two reasons. One, there's a window in which people may be infectious but not necessarily positive yet. And there may be a period of time in which we don't have the right strain of virus because it's a new novel virus. That's the worst problem. And then getting that test out and validating it and making sure that it's both reliable and sensitive enough for use. And so that's still a challenge.
You said fast science, rapid deployment, and added to that, would there be a training issue, rapid training for that particular test?
Absolutely. Rapid training, bringing people up to speed. Hopefully, the types of tests that will be developed would have some kind of standardized testing. I mean, the ideal test is one in which you, again, you put a particular body fluid on it, you have some stuff in a little bottle, you put a drop on it, and it turns color. And you can visually see it doesn't require any equipment. I mean, that's the ideal rapid screening test, and that one that has it's sensitive and specific. But that's a lot of stuff. That's a lot of technology, and that's a big deal. And it's and it's a challenge.
Well, now, on another issue, the APHA is seeking from OSHA some kind of temporary emergency standard for protecting first responders and healthcare workers. Can you tell us what you have in mind there?
This is about masks, and there's this huge challenge about masks. And, you know, the right now for kind of the standard mask that folks talk about using is H5N1 is a mask that fits very tightly. Mm-hmm. It's
is that the N95?
It's the N95 mask, and it basically filters out 95% of the particles that might come through. And the mask, though, has to fit very tightly. Mm-hmm. You can't wear a beard, and otherwise you breathe around the mask.
Sure.
And the real challenge is that's not the mask that healthcare providers in particular wear in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been arguing that there needs to be some certainty in terms of what mask to use so that there's some standard for people to utilize. The problem has been, even with the best science, there isn't enough knowledge out there yet to make a definitive decision. So even though we've been arguing for a definitive decision, I think we've also been arguing that we do the science to give us the answers. The Institute of Medicine has recently looked at the issue of masks. There have been several work groups that looked at the issue of masks, both within and out of the government. And the truth of the matter is, we just don't have the answers yet.
Mm-hmm.
Even an N95 mask worn improperly, forget about costs, mm-hmm. but an N95 mask worn improperly doesn't give you the protection mm-hmm. that you think it does.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a false sense of security. And so there's been this question about whether or not recommending a mask when you know people aren't going to wear it properly, are you really going to actually make more people sick mm-hmm. By inadvertent exposure?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been the dilemma. I don't have a good answer. Again, even though we're advocating for this standard to happen, some of our other colleagues, you know, the Hospital Association, for example, have argued, well, the cost is an issue, and then making sure people are properly trained to wear it. It's a big training issue, too. So we don't have the answer for that yet.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about NIMS. Does the association feel the public health community is fully familiar with NIMS? And if not, what needs to be done?
This whole incident management system, National Incident Management System, is one that is new to public health, you know, and it's new to medical practitioners. You know, we're kind of taught to be solo individuals, kind of go off and see a patient and practice on that individual patient. And even when you're doing population-based health, you know, mm-hmm. it's kind of you and the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this concept of working within a management structure where it's pyramidal and mm-hmm. there's somebody in charge and you kind of do what you're told to do. Not that you don't have intellectual thought as you go through that process, but and practice your profession, but that there's really a very much a command structure is very much a new concept mm-hmm. for public health. So we are still in the process of exposure, so that all of the public health practitioners have familiarization training for that kind of to being in that kind of system. Many of us who have worked in that system in other lives find it very useful. Because it works in terms of clarification of roles. And it also forces communication,
mm-hmm.
forces us to talk to each other and share information. I believe that it allows for effective shared decision making.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, someone's got to be in charge. So someone's going to actually be the person to make a decision. But to some degree, in fact, to a large degree, it allows for, if done right, for that the information to come in,
mm-hmm.
for it to be massaged, for it to move up the chain, and for the right people to get the right information to make the right decisions. And so what more needs to be done for public health? I think we need to expand it beyond the preparedness activity.
Mm-hmm.
We need to kind of practice it more and more because this whole issue of Dr. Gerberding at CDC calls it, and Lenny Marcus at Harvard call it meta-leadership. And it's this concept of leading across disciplines And so it's a concept where we talk about getting public health practitioners to understand and massage a bunch of disciplines into a cohesive whole. By the way, public health people do that all the time. We're one of the disciplines that does work across a variety of disciplines. We just haven't put it into our own practice methods. And so we're quite capable of doing that. We just need to do more of it.
Last question, going back to risk communication, which you mentioned earlier, I know the association is keenly aware of the need to put into place the solid risk communication strategies. In your view, is the CDC's National Health Alert Network fully up to task? And if not, what would you recommend?
The Health Alert Network actually has been a godsend. Another one of my stories. Again, 9/11 anthrax attacks, we really weren't getting really robust information in a timely manner. There was a lot of misinformation going around. And we felt very strongly at the state level that all the information needed to come to us, and then we would massage it and we would send it out to our communities. I freely admit we were wrong. The need to have accurate, authoritative information is a necessity, and CDC, through the Health Alert Network, has provided that. The next generation of improving on that system, even though they have gone out to practitioners broadly, there's still a lot of clinicians that don't know about it. And they can sign up. They can go to the CDC website and they can sign up for the clinician's version of these alerts. And so that is one thing that needs to happen. The other thing is timeliness. CDC really needs to be resourced through their National Center for Health Marketing, probably, and the Preparedness Center to make this more robust. And what I mean by that is to be able to give us information in a more timely manner, for them to, and to give that information out broadly, mm-hmm. For them to be able to understand what messages work real well in terms of, right now they're just simply pushing out information. But they've really asked us to do anything with that information. You know, it's basically just been scientific information going out to clinicians and out practitioners. But if you really wanted to mobilize practitioners, in other words, let's say there was an attempt and it was a need to identify epidemiologists to go to a response scene and to use all the tools that we have, the either Citizen Corps or Medical Response Corps individuals, and to mobilize them. Right now, that system is not timely enough to, you know, to mobilize those folks. And they could do it. They would just have to divert resources to do it. But they could do it if they had to. But I think I would love to see them better resourced to be able to do that all the time. Again, mm-hmm. I believe strongly that people do best what they do every day. Mm-hmm. So this is not something I would like them to have to just make up on the spur. Mm-hmm. But building a response capacity into that, I think, would be very helpful.
Well, Dr. Benjamin, it's been a long interview, but most informative. And I want to thank you for taking the extra time to be with us today. And I want to thank you also for your service to our country.
John, thank you very much. I enjoy being here.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness podcast interview. Thank you for listening.